Thank you to all of our presenters. I think we have a few minutes left to take some questions. And for any questions that we don't have time to get to, we will provide answers in writing that we'll post to the website along with the presentations and the audio files. So, Lauren, if you want to kick off the questions.
Sure. Our first question is for Joel. Is there a presentation or information that is available for the healthcare sector to start to adapt to the public health concerns due to climate change?
That's a great question, and unequivocally the answer is yes. There's been a lot of excellent work that's been done by the public health community itself to look at, number one, the potential impacts of climate change on public health, but number two, also proactive interventions that states and local communities can take. As a quick aside, not surprisingly, since climate change tends to exacerbate problems that already exist due to other socioeconomic stressors, many of the things that you would do to adapt to climate change are actually enhancements to existing public health interventions. Now, I promise I'll post online, as Emma said, the key references you might want to look at. But just to whet your interest, number one, in 2000, EPA released the first major assessment of climate change on human health, along with recommendations that can be used. That can be found on the website for the U.S. Global Change Research Program, which is www.climatescience.gov, and you'll find it under publications. Number two, again, just to give you a sense for where some of these major resources are, there is a book that the World Health Organization released just a few years ago, which EPA actually sponsored, that talks about risks and responses to climate change. Number three, it's not all being done at the federal level. Several states already have adaptation strategies that explicitly talk about human health. And I'll give you one example, just because I personally was involved in it. The state of Maryland is about to release its revised climate change adaptation strategy, and it has an entire chapter on human health that I was lucky enough to help author, and it contains very detailed recommendations for the state on how they can deal with the health impacts. Number four, if you go to the CDC website, they have a climate change page with information on potential interventions. So again, that's just to whet your interest. The resources are there, and we'll post these references for you on the website.
Great. Thanks, Joel. And then another question for you. Could you provide an example on climate change and management of invasive species?
Great question. I appreciate that question because we didn't get a chance to talk about it today, but climate change can, in fact, exacerbate the problems posed by invasive species. When invasive species are introduced for other reasons, for example, on ships coming into the Great Lakes region, climate change can create an ecological environment over which these invasive species can either begin to survive or in fact spread. And as I said, this is an issue of concern in places like Chicago, which is very concerned about it. I'll give you a short but hopefully very helpful response. In 2009, EPA released a major report focused explicitly on the implications of climate change for invasive species, and the report laid out management practices that could be implemented to account for the exacerbation of the problem by climate change. And I would note that this report, in the spirit of some of what David said, this report was developed in partnership with regional and state resource managers who are already dealing with invasive species, and we worked with them to understand how those management practices could be augmented to account for climate change. And again, we'll post that on the website. So it's not one specific management example, but there's a whole report there, and we'll get it to you.
Great. Thanks, Joel. And then this next question is for you, David. Are there statistics available for approximate percentages within the general population of how many people fall into the individualist, communitarian, or hierarchist, egalitarian categories? And how might knowing such information or studies help us communicate climate change-related issues? And do you know if these percentages are trending or changing?
there are no generalities with cultural cognition because it depends on the issue. There are people who could be really libertarian on some things and really communitarian on the other end of that continuum on others. So it depends on the issue. So there is no single general truth. There are great statistics on a number of issues at the website that I posted in my slides, which is www.culturalcognition.net, just one word. The point I would make is this. I hoped to help you understand that the argument over whether climate change is real or not is being waged with the weapons of the facts, but it's about something much deeper. So just trying to wage it with the facts, one form of risk communication, is insufficient. And having a sense from your local community where they land on that sort of a way of thinking will help you have a more successful and less contentious relationship in the part of your community that has the extreme believers and the extreme deniers, because their extremes are coming from something other than the facts, and just arguing it based on the facts is going to get you nowhere. But in terms of specific details, I would look to culturalcognition.net, and in answer to the second part of your question, the current issues of the day certainly change what's important to us. So I've written in several blogs recently that the more threatened people feel by an uncertain future, like the economy, the more tribal, if you will, is what I call it, the more cultural cognition will matter, because the more we need tribe to keep us safe. So that can make it a stronger motivator. We certainly saw that in the recent vote. But the most important point is to think about that perspective in the relationships you're trying to nurture with better risk communication so that you can achieve the kind of adaptation you're after.
Okay, great. Thank you for that response. And then the next question is for Brendan. You presented a planning matrix in your presentation, and this attendee wanted to know how you came up with the likelihood and consequence numbers that were assigned in the planning matrix.
So, like I sort of mentioned, we sat down. Well, for the likelihood factor, we sat down with some local researcher, Dan Kahan at University of California, San Diego, Scripps Institute, who is involved in the IPCC and everything, and we we kind of just went through and tried to score the likelihood of some of these impacts. Again, it was informed by the San Diego Foundation's Focus 2050 study, which had been a much larger collaborative effort between multiple research institutions in the area. And then for the consequence side, that was really more scored by staff, because it really had to do with, what does a vulnerability mean to our own city operations and our community services, et cetera. So, again, due to our budget constraints, we had to take more of a, if you will, almost a qualitative approach to it. I think the last thing I just would mention is that, our stakeholders were, fairly comfortable with that. And part of that was because in implementing an adaptation plan, part of the, that is you'd be going back and reassessing what the best available data is, what are your assumptions and are they still holding true? So they did see it as sort of a long-term continual improvement process.
Okay, great. Thank you.
One more question.
Sure. I have one more lined up for Brendan. How much staff time and resources did Chula Vista commit to this effort, and how long did it take from start to adoption?
Well, we started the process. We had our first climate change working group meeting in December of 2009, and we presented, or the climate change working group presented their recommendations to council on October 7th. So about 10 months there. And as far as staff time, we just sort of estimating. We held a working group meeting about every 3 weeks, and the meeting themselves were 2 hours long, and there was probably another 2 hours of prep time and sort of post-meeting debrief work. So it was definitely not it wasn't a small amount of time. We again really leveraged our in-kind resources from ICLEI, as well as someone from the San Diego Foundation who helped do a lot of the initial research. And all of that, I just would want to say, is, you know, all of this information is available on the City of Chula Vista's website under our clean web portal. There's a link to it on our homepage. So feel free to, you know, use the information that we gathered. It might shorten another local jurisdiction's process, hopefully.
Thank you, Brendan. And we're happy to post the link to that website with the question and answers so folks can get to that information as well. Thank you to everyone for participating today. If there are any questions that we didn't get to, we will post those answers in writing. And I encourage all the participants to, as you exit out of our webcast today, to participate in the optional feedback survey and give us your thoughts on what we can cover here at EPA in future webcasts, and what tools and resources would be helpful for you in implementing your adaptation efforts. We will be holding the second session of this webcast series on December 15th, where we'll get into more detail on the processes of planning adaptation strategies and actually working towards implementation. And we will have state and local speakers to share their experiences as case studies. So we hope that you will join us then. Thank you again, and thanks to all our speakers for your time and your wonderful presentations.
Thanks for having us.